Okay, so, got a lot to cover today, so I'm gonna jump in. First of all, let's get the right lecture up. So everybody should have gotten an email. Is there anybody who didn't get an email about the new deadline for the homework assignment?
Yeah.
Just you. Okay, sorry, Nika. I'll have to check. I mean, that must mean I'm sending it to somebody else then. So I guess they really like to learn about PCHEM. Let's see. So this question we talked about, or we introduced it right before the end of the class. So at 25 degrees, which has a higher heat capacity? 100 grams or 500 grams of water? Anybody have venture a guess?
500.
500, right, that's right. So when you're dealing with something very small, it makes sense that it's not gonna take a whole lot of heat to raise that guy up a degree or two. When you're dealing with something quite large, like the earth or a mountain, it's gonna take a whole lot of heat to increase the temperature by a degree or two. So in that sense, the heat capacity is related to or proportional to the size. And specifically, we have two different types of heat capacities that people often talk about. The first, that's trash. Let's see if I can, yes. The first is called the molar heat capacity. I'll just call it molar CP or molar C. And when you're representing something as a molar quantity, so heat capacity per mole, the convention or the traditional convention is to put a bar over it. Okay, so if you see CP bar, that means that you're talking about heat capacity per mole. And so, just from last time, what are the units of heat capacity? Joules per Kelvin, right? Remember the definition of heat capacity is delta Q over delta T, right? So this is gonna be heat, so this is joules, energy, and then this is gonna be Kelvin. And so this gets right to the distinction that we were making. Normal heat capacity represented as a quantity is going to be joules per Kelvin, but here we're doing molar heat capacity where we have joules per Kelvin per mole, or we can do specific heat capacity, which is what brings, right? Specific heat capacity, which is dedicated or drawn by a star, at least in this class it is, and that would be joules per Kelvin per gram. Now, obviously, if you know the molecular weight of a compound or the formula weight of a compound, you can always convert between the specific versus the molar heat capacity. So to use our example here, if we have 100 grams of water versus 500 grams of water, the overall heat capacity of that system is going to be different. But the heat capacity per mole or per gram is not going to change. And so if you want to calculate the heat capacity of 100 grams of water, you would take the specific heat capacity and multiply it by 100 grams, and then you would get your joules per Kelvin, which would be specific to that system. Does that make sense? So this has to do with what we in thermodynamics call intensive versus, okay, so there's that. I just wrote on the board, but intensive versus extensive property. Okay, so properties like heat capacity that depend on the size of the system, the number of moles, the number of grams, whatever, those are called in thermodynamics an extensive property. And the way that you remember that is you think they extend as the property gets bigger. So if I make, if I take, let's see, the volume of a box that's directly proportional, if it's a solid, to the number of moles inside that box. So if I double the size of the box, I double the size of the number of moles, right? You know, same if I take, heat capacity, if I take, let's see, what's another good extensive property? We're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, but if you think about Gibbs energy, so Gibbs energy is usually expressed as joules per mole, right? So because it's a molar quantity, you know, it's a value per mole of something, it's going to be an extensive property or an extensive variable or however you want to call it. The opposite is intensive, okay? So an intensive property is a property that's independent, so you got the IN, independent, intensive, of the system size. And so an example of an intensive property is going to be the molar heat capacity or the overall, you know, I guess I've probably mixed you guys up. Free energy as in delta G per mole is intensive. Free energy as overall kilojoules or overall heat is extensive. Apologize for that. But your molar heat capacity, because it doesn't depend on the size, is intensive. Pressure, if I take a gas at, you know, one atmosphere, it doesn't matter if I'm looking at a tiny little speck of gas or a tiny little container of gas or a great big bucket of gas. One atmosphere doesn't have anything to do with the system size. Temperature is the same way. Temperature of a 1 gram, you know, weight at 300 Kelvin is going to be the same as the temperature of a 300 gram weight at 300 Kelvin. If the temperature is the same, it doesn't matter. So if I take my 300 gram weight and I break it up into, you know, 300 1 gram fragments, each one of those is going to still weigh the same. Yeah?
So the specific heat would be intensive and the molar heat would be?
The specific and molar are both intensive.
Even though they're per mole?
Per mole, because mole is the same thing as the size of the system, the number of molecules. Okay? And really the way you think about it is sort of the example that I just said. If I have a box, so I have this chair, right? Now the chair is formed of different materials, but if I measure the temperature of this position and I divide this chair into a whole bunch of little bits, the temperature is not going to change. If I cut up with a chainsaw, yes, the temperature will change. But if I could do all of this without perturbing the chair at all, the temperature is going to be the same as it is. It's not going to depend on the size. If I take a box of gas and in my mind I divide it up into two halves, the temperature of one half isn't different from the temperature of the other half. On the other hand, if I divide it in two halves, the volume of one half is going to be smaller than the volume, than the original. Right? So volume is an extensive property. Pressure is an intensive property. If I take my box of gas, I divide it into two halves, the pressure on the right is still going to be the same as the pressure on the left. It doesn't matter what the volume of the gas is. And so that's where this distinction between molar and specific, I mean, these are the same, these are both intensive, versus overall heat capacity, which is defined here as just C, comes from. So again, heat capacity of a 500 gram versus 100 gram is going to be different. Molar heat capacity or heat capacity per gram is not going to be different because you've divided that out. Yeah.
So if it's a property that is, something per mole, that's intensive because it's that's
just because you've divided it out, exactly.
Per mole, whereas if you're just saying, okay, I'm applying that property to X number of moles or like something where you're applying it to like a.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
If you take like a chemical reaction and so you go back to your Chem 1, you calculate your chemical reaction where you take hydrogen, oxygen, and you form water. Obviously, if you have a lot of hydrogen and oxygen, you're going to get more heat, right? But the heat per mole
is
going to be the same.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Okay. So now if we go back, and I think we probably touched on this on Tuesday, but if we go back and now think about specific heat capacity, and we go from what was originally Q is equal to C delta T, right? And if we express it now with this specific heat capacity, now we're going to get our M Cp delta T. And so what this is saying is that the overall heat capacity of a system is equal to the specific heat capacity times the mass. And this is the familiar equation that you're probably all used to at this point. Questions on that? No? Yeah.
If we write that on the homework or in test, we need to put the star in the B. We can't just put C.
It probably depends on the situation. But if I tell you that your system is at constant volume, and you write Cp, then I'm gonna wonder why you wrote Cp, unless you can give me a good reason. Similarly, if you're looking up a gas and you're going into a table of data, if you don't know which table to go to, Cp or Cv, then it's going to make a difference. So, but that'll become more clear as we do some more practice problems and continue on through the semester. Hopefully it'll become more clear. Okay, so now we've sort of talked about work, we've talked about heat. We need to talk about one more thing before we can start introducing the laws of the thermodynamics. And that's called the internal energy. And we'll talk about this quite a bit today. Oops. Internal energy, usually in class, it's going to be represented by capital E. So this is a postulated property. So remember I said that thermodynamics came about in the 1800s when people didn't necessarily know everything about molecules and atoms. And so they had to sort of come up, they had to think about physics and think about how things were working in the sense of postulates. So the same reason that we postulate that an integer, a positive integer, is going to be greater than a negative integer. That's basically a definition. And so the thermodynamicists early on came up with some definitions, some ground rules for how matter was supposed to behave. And the reason that thermodynamics was so successful was because those ground rules, which on the one hand seem entirely arbitrary, seem to do a very good job of describing how nature worked. Okay, and so they came up with this idea that all systems, so internal energy is a property of a system, have this property called the internal energy. And that internal energy can change depending on whether a system has heat added to it, emits heat, does work, has work done to it. Okay, and so they came up with this idea that internal energy has to be a property of every system you could possibly conceive. And so you can practice it on the way home. You can look at the trash can in the hallway. That trash can, as a system, has an internal energy. The stairwell, as a system, it's very big, but it has an internal energy. You and I, you could imagine each of us have an internal energy when taken as a system. Your pencil, anything that you can imagine, has this property called an internal energy. And that's going to be very important because the laws of thermodynamics are essentially all about how your internal energy changes as you do things, as you react one compound with another, as you add heat or change the volume of a particular system. But remember that the internal energy is fundamentally a property of systems, and we'll have to think about how things relate to the surroundings, okay? And so the internal energy, because it's a property, we can calculate things about it. And for the first third of the class, that's essentially what we're going to be doing. We're going to be calculating things about the internal energy. And so now we've introduced, since the internal energy is energy, unit-wise, it has to have energies or units of joules. But now that we've introduced work, we've introduced heat, we've introduced internal energy, we can start thinking about the laws of thermodynamics. Okay, and so again, these were postulated. They sort of came up with reasonable expectations, and then the idea was, okay, here's some ideas, let's test these in the lab to see if they actually hold to be true. Okay, and so the first technical law isn't really a law. I mean, this was sort of assumed, this goes all the way back to, you know, physics, but it's helpful to think of it as a law. And a lot of times you'll hear it described as the zeroth law of thermodynamics. And the reason that you have that is because the first law was already taken, but this is kind of more fundamental. But the zeroth law of thermo is that all energy is neither created nor destroyed. So I can talk about how energy is transferred from the system to the surroundings, or I can talk about how energy goes from the surroundings to the system, but I can't talk about how energy just disappears, or energy is created from nothing. So the zeroth law of thermo is essentially telling us that energy is conserved. If you lose energy, you have to be able to account for it in some other part of the system or the surroundings. It has to go somewhere. So it's a very fundamental property. We're not going to talk too much about it because it is so basic. But let's just establish, again, our ground rules. So if that's the zeroth law, what's the first law? Well, the first law has to do with how the internal energy is related to work done by the system and heat added to a system. Okay, and so the first law of thermodynamics And we're gonna sit on this law for a while, so we'll keep reviewing this over the next few lectures. But the first law of thermodynamics says that the change in internal energy, of a system, remember internal energy is a property of the system, is exactly equal, so it's not approximately equal, it's not just about or close enough, it's exactly equal to the sum of, work done by the system and heat added to the system. Okay, so that's the first law of thermodynamics in words. I'll give you a second or two to write that down. And if you're thinking about this, you might have realized, well, I can write this as an equation, and that's what we're going to do. So the first law of thermo is also easily written as an equation. Delta E, so the change in internal energy, is equal to Q, which is heat added to a system, plus W, which is work done by the system. So who can remember back to our convention on Tuesday, is work done by the system positive or negative?
Negative.
It's negative. And so sometimes you'll see in other textbooks, somebody might write this as Q minus W, because they might say that work done by the system is positive. But it makes a little bit more sense to me, and it's the convention of your textbook, that work done by the system is positive or is negative, and therefore you can write your first law as Q plus W. Okay? So already we can start thinking about the properties of the internal energy. And so for an isolated system, what is delta E going to be?
Zero.
It has to be zero, because there can be no work done by an isolated system. There can be no heat added to or taken away from an isolated system. Okay, let's see. So if, well, let's take a quick second to look back at our question of the day from last time. And I'm going to change some of the wording around, but fundamentally it'll be the same question. So if I take some water from the freshest dew of the Swiss Alps, and I purify it and eliminate all of the impurities, and I take that water and I put it in a glass on the table here, to use your imagination, and then I take Starkville tap water, and I purify it, I get it to the same exact level of purity, I keep it to the same temperature, the same pressure, put it in a very similar glass, the exact same amount of water, and I put that in the glass next to it. What do you think the difference in internal energy is between one glass and the other?
None.
It has to be zero, right? Internal energy cannot depend on how you got the system to a particular state. Okay, in that sense, we call internal energy path independent. So if I give you a piece of matter or some chemical or some compound, and I tell you that I purified this from, you know, painstaking dissection of goat's livers, and I put it on the thing, and then I give you another thing that I said I synthesized in the organic chemistry lab, and put it on the table, the internal energy of those systems has to be the same. As long as you have the same material, the same volume, the same pressure, the same number of moles, all of that, you're going to have no difference in the internal energy. So in that sense, delta E we call path independence, but clearly, you know, the work done as far as what the system has to do to get the compound in that state is going to be quite different from what the surroundings do. You know, the surroundings are drastically different whether I purify something from goat livers or whether I synthesize in the lab. And so generally when we're thinking about heat and work, you know, if you have an engine and that's taking, you know, in your system is the gas inside the engine, and you blow up some gasoline to heat up that gas and make it expand, you know, not all of the heat generated by the surroundings, that is the engine, get transferred into the gas itself, right? Some of it's wasted. And so we have to make a distinction between what's going on in the system versus the surroundings. And the surroundings can be quite different, but still give us the same internal energy in the end. Okay? But if I can come up with, and we'll talk about this today in a little bit, if I can come up with, if I'm going from a transition, I guess, from state A to state B, and I can come up with a path that I can calculate to get from state A to state B, then the internal energy has to be the same, even if that's not the actual path that I take to get there. And this is one of the hardest concepts for thermodynamicists to grasp, right? If I blow something up, if I take some C4 plastic explosives and blow up this table, that's obviously going to be a very difficult thing to calculate how I can do. But If I can somehow come up with a physical process where I, you know, very carefully pull the table apart and measure all of my heats and works and everything, keep all of my counting, I can the delta E, the change in internal energy of the table, has to be the same because the internal energy doesn't depend on the path. So we'll get to some more concrete examples here in a second, but it's very important to recognize that delta E doesn't depend on how you get to the system, or how you get the system to its final state. Okay, so that's where we should have ended on Tuesday. But fortunately, some of this is review for today. So I think we can skip this. Okay, so now we've covered this interesting property called the internal energy. When thermodynamicists started out thinking about internal energy, they didn't have any idea what that meant. They just said there is something called the internal energy. Now looking back from the 21st century, we can talk about molecules and relate our understanding of molecules and kinetic theory to what the internal energy actually means. And so when I'm talking about the internal energy, now I can say, you know, if my system is a tryptophan molecule, there are lots of different contributions to the internal energy. You know, if you're really hardcore physics, everything has an mc squared energy, right? Everything that has mass has an energy potential that you can calculate with mc squared. That's more there for the physicist in the audience. But if you think about bond vibrations, so you've all have some experience of what infrared spectroscopy is, right? So if you think about bond vibrations, that's a type of internal energy. If there's a charge interaction, for example, between this amino and carboxy group, that has a certain contribution to the internal energy. The covalent bonds between atoms, all, again, you can break those and get energy out, so that has a contribution to the internal energy. And if this tryptophan is in some sort of gas form and it's flying around the room or flying around in the vacuum, it's going to have kinetic and motional energy as well, right? So when I'm talking about the internal energy, in some sense, if I knew all of those things, I can calculate what the internal energy is. But in another sense, most of the time when I'm doing these types of experiments or when I'm doing thermodynamics, I'm changing the system, so I'm more interested in the change in internal energy. Okay, so if I change my tryptophan molecule from, you know, water to 4-molar salt solution, that's probably going to change like the ionic interactions. It's probably going to change a little bit of the bond vibrations, but the mc squared energy is not going to change. And so some of those contributions will change, some of them will drop out, but if I'm interested in just the difference, so the change in the internal energy from the initial state versus the final state, I don't necessarily have to know all of the molecular details. And that's why thermodynamics is so powerful, because I don't have to take into account all of these things to get the right answer. Okay, another example would be gas sitting in a container. So our system is the gas. Again, the system has the internal energy. That's the property of the system. But here, for our oxygen gas, our internal energy would be made up of bond vibrations between the two oxygen molecules. The covalent bond, if you cleave that bond, again, you're going to get energy out. Interaction energies between the gas molecules themselves. And then also kinetic and rotational energy as well, so just like for the tryptophan molecule. So these things have a kinetic emotional energy, but they also have a lot of different types of chemical energy stored in them. And that essentially wraps up, what the internal energy is. The internal energy, we can conceptualize it and just say, well, it's E. But if you're thinking from a molecular point of view, the internal energy is something that's composed of all of these different contributions. Okay, so we could also think back to the molecular basis or the small scale basis of the heat capacity. Okay, and so we talked about the heat capacity on Tuesday and how it's different for water, ice, and water vapor. But here, you know, you can start reasoning why that is. Okay, and so if you think about what the heat capacity is telling us, it's essentially, again, it's telling us how much energy can be absorbed before you see a change in temperature. And so we could write this for the heat capacity as delta T is equal to delta Q over C. So if I add a lot of heat and I have a very big heat capacity, delta T is going to be small. If I add the same amount of heat, have a very little heat capacity, delta T is going to be bigger, right? So the bigger my heat capacity, the more energy I can add to the system before I start to see it heat up. And probably, I mean, who knows what temperature is? What does temperature measure?
Average kinetic energy,
that's my boy. That's good. So temperature, so you guys remember, you covered a little bit of kinetic theory in Chem 2, right? Gen Chem 2, maybe? Okay, well remember that all of molecules in gas, in solids and liquids, are moving around somewhat. I mean, that's called Brownian motion. But obviously it's much more dramatic in a gaseous form. And temperature is essentially measuring the speed or the kinetic energy of those molecules as they move around, as they bounce around inside the room. And so something with a very high temperature, like if you stick your hand in a hot oven, those gas molecules in your oven are going to be jumping around like crazy. They're going to be moving around at hundreds or thousands of meters per second. Whereas something very cold doesn't hardly move at all. And so the heat capacity, in some sense, has to tell us something about how easy or hard it is to take energy from the surroundings and translate that energy into kinetic motion inside the system itself. Okay? Because if I take some amount of energy, if the heat capacity is low, that means that amount of energy is translated almost immediately into, you know, kinetic energy of the molecules. Whereas the heat capacity is high, that energy is translated into something else. And so when you think about heat capacity, you can think of it almost as a system's ability to take energy from the surroundings and convert it into something other than kinetic or velocity, you know, molecular motion. Okay, so if I have a high heat capacity, I take some energy in from my surroundings, and I can do lots of different things with it. So, for example, let's think about water. Okay, so if I have a solid chunk of ice, and I absorb some heat from the environment, water is very rigid. Right? There's obviously energy in the bonds, and there's obviously energy in the hydrogen bonds, but there's not a whole lot that water can do or ice can do with that energy. You know, if I give it energy, it's not like I can start breaking the hydrogen bonds, because that's going to destroy the, you know, it's not going to be ice anymore. So ice, in that sense, when you give it some energy, it has to take that energy and basically translate it almost, you know, directly into kinetic motion. It can store some energy, but it can't store a whole lot. Whereas compared to water, water can do all sorts of things with the energy that you give it. You put some energy into water, you can make or form new hydrogen bonds, you can do bond vibrations, bond rotations. That energy can go into all sorts of different things before it actually increases the velocity of the water molecules in the glass that you're heating up. Okay? But now let's think about water vapor. So water vapor is you know, again, there's not a whole lot of, water is very spread out in water vapor. So there's no hydrogen bonds. There's no sort of molecular, or very little molecular interaction between water molecules and water vapor. And so now if I add heat to water vapor, or if I add heat to water vapor, now again, it's much more easy for that water vapor to increase in velocity. That water vapor translates more readily into thermal energy, which is motion. And so we would predict, we might not be able to predict rank order, but we can predict that the heat capacity of water liquid would be higher than both ice and water vapor. And if we look at the actual values, that's actually what happens. Okay, so when I heat up ice, again, pretty much the only place that energy can go, it can't really go into forming or breaking new hydrogen bonds. It pretty much has to make the water molecules speed up, which translates into a temperature change. Whereas if I heat up water, it has an extremely high heat capacity because there's lots of bonds and different types of rotational orientations that energy can go in and excite without actually making the water move physically faster. And then similarly for steam, now all of those interesting bond orientations and hydrogen bonding and things like that, they're gone, so you basically have to heat up you have to transfer your energy into velocity again. Okay, the other thing to notice about this slide, again, remember on Tuesday I said that the heat capacity at constant pressure versus constant volume was approximately the same for liquids and solids, but it's different for gases. Okay. Let's see. So when you think about heat capacity, and there's a handout for this too, which hopefully you picked up at the beginning of class, is where can the energy go beside kinetic energy? And so if you have a system with lots and lots of bonds, lots and lots of different things that those bonds can do as far as rotate, vibrate, whatever, then there's lots of ways for that energy to be spread out before the actual molecule starts to speed up or the velocity increases. And so another way of thinking about this is the degrees of molecular freedom in a particular molecule. Okay. So here, this goes back to our question that we were talking about with water at the question of the day for last time. The answer is essentially the same. The point here is, again, for the internal energy, it doesn't matter how I got there. If I give you nitrogen gas and I pulled it or extracted it somehow from the air, the atmosphere, or that I pulled it from either high altitude or I use some chemical process, the nitrogen gas has to have the same internal energy if it's at this under the same conditions. And so in that perspective or in that sense, we can think of the internal energy as a function. So just like you have a function f of x that you probably hate in calculus. That got me a look. F of x, nobody likes that. But you can think of the internal energy as a function of a couple of different variables. So like you could think of being as a function of the volume, the number of moles, the pressure. Depending on the system, you might have other types of things. But in this sense, you have a function of a whole bunch of different variables. And if those variables are the same, again, from the internal energy's point of view, it doesn't matter how you got those variables to those values. The internal energy is going to be the same because the internal energy is a function. And that brings us to this idea of state variables, or variables of state. Okay, so state variables, as you might imagine, are variables or properties or numbers or values, however you want to describe it, that describe the state of a system. And so pressure would be a state variable. Volume would be a state variable. Number. Internal energy is actually a state variable, right? All of these things, if I give you a gas at one atmosphere, it doesn't matter whether you compressed that gas to get it to one atmosphere or you expanded it to get it to one atmosphere. It's only a function of the state, and it only matters what the state, they only describe the current state of the system. Okay, and so the list here, pressure, temperature, volume, number, there might be more. State variables might be described as, if number is in here, you might think of number as relating to concentration. So if you have a chemical reaction and a certain number of moles of one compound versus another compound, that might describe the state of that system, right? So in that sense, number and concentration can be a state variable as well. And so we have this idea where it's path independent, it's only dependent on the current configuration of the state. Why might it make sense that heat and work would not be state variables?
On the work, like the system heat affecting the surroundings or the surroundings affecting the system.
What do you mean exactly?
Because like you're either doing work to the system or the work doing the system doing work to the surroundings. So it's not just with the system.
That's true. I think yes, it doesn't have to do only with the system. So there's a surroundings that's involved. And so in that sense, yes. I think what maybe you're trying to get at is this idea of path independence. So if I, for example, if I push this chair from here to the corner, I'm doing a certain amount of work against friction, right? So that amount of work that I'm doing, I start at point A, I end at point B, but now if I push the chair back to where I started, because I'm going over a different path, I'm doing a different amount of work against friction. And so in that sense, work is not a state variable because it depends on how you go from point A to point B. It doesn't depend on the system's starting point and the ending point. It depends on how you get there. You could imagine that heat is the same way. So in the example I gave earlier about the engine, you know, the engine, depending on the engine's efficiency and how the gasoline is actually injected into the piston and then set on fire by the spark plug, depending on how that works, the heat might be more efficiently transferred to the gas or less efficiently transferred to the gas. And so heat is the same kind of thing. Depending on how you go from point A to point B, you're probably going to have a different amount of heat added to the system or heat taken from the system. So here's a question for us. So I've written on this slide a couple of things called state equations. So they're basically combinations of state variables. I'm going to write one here on the board. I'm going to write big because it's important. Okay, H is equal to E plus PV. Now, if I have an equation that's made up of state variables, is that equation or that value also a state variable? So think about this at your table. Why don't you guys discuss it for a minute or two? So the question is, here I have this quantity H, and H is dependent on E, which is a state variable. It only depends on the state. P and V, which are properties of the state, so they only depend on the state as well. So is H a state variable? Is H path independent? Is it independent of state there? So talk about it and then we'll ask you guys in a few minutes. You can be loud.
Thank you.
Okay. What do you guys say, yes or no? Well, is it a state verb or is it not a state verb?
I think it is.
You think it is? You guys think it is?
No, we say no.
Okay, well it is. It is because, for example, if the energy only depends on the number, and I change the number, and the energy has to change, P and V probably aren't affected by the number, and therefore, everything in this equation is only dependent on the state of the system. And so if everything on the right-hand side is only dependent on the state of the system, everything on the left-hand side is also only dependent on the state of the system. And so this is a very important state equation, or equation of state. As you might have guessed, this is the definition of enthalpy. And so that's why it's so important. Enthalpy is defined as an internal energy plus the pressure and the volume of the system. Okay? Notice that there's no deltas here. This is not delta H. This is defined as actual H. We're going to get to delta H, but first we have to sort of start with the definition before we can actually calculate what the change in enthalpy is over a set of different conditions. Okay, so let's see. If I wanted to calculate delta H, so delta H is the change in H from a final, final state minus initial state, right? So it follows that if I want delta H, then again, delta H is just, the delta operator or delta, whatever you want to call it. If I take the change in this side, I have to calculate the change in this side. And so delta H is equal to delta E plus delta, the quantity PV. Okay, so the reason I just can't take delta P times delta V actually goes back to your chain rule in calculus. We're not going to get into the chain rule right now. I know that would be too depressing for the end of the week right before Labor Day weekend. But for this very simple approach, if you want to calculate delta H, you have to know delta E, and you have to know delta P times V. Now, in many cases, delta P times V you can approximate as simply P2 V2 minus P1 V1. That's all that means. It just means the change in the quantity P times V. So if the final quantity P times V is P2 V2, and the initial quantity P times V is P1 V1, then delta the quantity P times V is P2 V2 minus P1 V1. And delta E, again, we'll show you how to calculate it. The first thing, though, that we do when we want to calculate delta E, delta H, delta whatever, is we have to think about the path that we're going to take. So if I want to expand the balloon, for example, such that the pressure, the volume, and the temperature are all changing at the same time, and I want to calculate the change in state, the delta E of the gas in the balloon from point A to point B, again, if I know how to calculate the internal energy, it can't matter whether I calculate the internal energy over one path where I hold P constant and then get T and V to the appropriate values and then change P in the final analysis, or if I take a different path where I change them all at the same time, or if I hold T constant in the first step and do a series of steps to get me from point A to point B. Again, because energy is a state function, if I can design a path to go from state A to state B, and I can calculate Q and W along every leg of that path, then it doesn't matter if that's the actual path that was done. If the initial and the final energies are the final states are the same, delta E has to be the same. And so that's something that we're going to be thinking about, is what's the path that we can use? Where can we actually calculate, or what can we calculate so that we can get at delta E versus delta H versus, you know, we'll get on to entropy and other stuff later on. But so when we think about paths, we can think of a couple of different types of paths. Isobaric, anybody know what that means? Constant pressure. I'm trying to know these things can get in the way, but that's a P. Isochoric. Yes, constant volume. Isothermal. Constant temperature, yep. So, what about adiabatic? What did you say first?
Heat.
Heat. Is that a new term to everybody? Possibly? Adiabatic means there's no delta Q, or there's no heat transferred between, I'll write adiabatic because that would be helpful. Adiabatic means that there's no delta Q, so no heat transferred from the surroundings to the system, or vice versa. So in an adiabatic situation, it actually makes calculating delta E a little easier, right? Because delta E, back to our first law, is Q plus W. In the adiabatic system, there's no Q. So all you have to calculate is W.
Wait, there's no heat, or there's no heat transfer?
There's no heat transfer. Yeah, so
there,
I guess.
Could be heat from,
well, there's going to be heat for everything, right? Yeah. I mean, just, you know, even the sitting there has a certain heat. But generally, when you're talking about heat, you're talking about heat transfer.
Okay.
So, let's see. Trying to think if it's better to go through this and then do examples, or maybe sacrifice an example, but we'll see. Okay, so let's think about a gaseous system. You'll find that we're using a lot of gaseous systems in this class because gases are relatively easy to calculate. When I say relatively easy, I mean they're not trivial, but we have PV equals NRT, right? So that gives us a really good way to relate properties and state variables in a gas. And so when we're thinking about calculating changes to the internal energy and the enthalpy, we have a couple of steps that we have to do. And so this is conceptual steps that you can work through. I can't give you, like from Chem 1, they say, you know, when you're solving a limiting reagent problem, you do this, 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 and this. Unfortunately, you can't do that with PChem. But this is about as close as you can get to it. So these are things to think about when you're trying to calculate changes in enthalpy and the internal energy. So you have to think about the path that you're going to take for the change. So if you're just talking about state A to state B, again, the path is up to you. You can arbitrarily say, well, I want to calculate it over this path, or I want to choose this path instead. If you're just saying, what's the internal energy change as you go from this state to this state, well, then you have a little bit of freedom to do this. But most of the times you're going to say, here's path one, here's path two, calculate the internal energy. So that, in that sense, it's helping you because you don't have to come up with a path yourself. But when you do have a situation that you have to come up with a path on your own, pick the one that you can do. I mean, that's the whole point of path independence. If you pick a path that you can calculate, you can use it. So when we consider the path of change, we have to remember a couple of things. One, most changes that you make to a system, that you as the surroundings make to a system, are going to be irreversible. If I take a piston of gas and I compress it really quickly, that's going to be an irreversible change. That means that you're not There's no easy way. Well, that means you're not 100% efficient in how you transfer your work and your heat to the system. Okay, and that's, to put that another way, there's no easy way to calculate Q and W in the first law. So if you're doing an irreversible change, calculating Q and W is hard. If you have a, yeah?
This might be wrong, but is that kind of like the question that we have in our homework for walking through Starbucks, the hand, like you move that heat as you move over,
uh-huh,
and you put it back in? Is that kind of like that, or is that just something else?
Well, I think in that case, the change, I mean, in some sense is irreversible because you're not going to get that heat back. That actually gets to a much deeper question as far as what's spontaneous. But for that particular question, a very simple answer would be to say this material wouldn't have been taught normally when you submit. So if I had gotten through all of the lecture material that I wanted to get through on Tuesday, you would have been able to answer that question without having to know what the path and stuff like that is. So that's the cheater answer. That's probably the more practical answer that you care about too. But yes, it is spontaneous that it loses heat. But I think you're asked there not so much, what's the path that it's taking, but if you can calculate what the energy loss is. And again, because you know temperature at the first point, temperature at the second point, you can calculate heat based on MCP delta T. Again, it's a state function, so you don't have to know exactly how it lost that heat. So I guess implicitly it does involve these types of issues. So if we can devise a reversible path to go from state 1 to state 2, reversible typically means that heat or work done by the surroundings is equal to the work done on the system, and the heat absorbed from the surroundings is equal to, or the heat taken from the surroundings is equal to the heat added to the system. So generally when you're doing a reversible path, you're doing very, very small changes so that under all circumstances you're sort of at a microscopic equilibrium where, you know, if I'm moving up my piston, I can measure a very small amount of work on my hand, and all of that work is being transferred to the gas in the piston itself. Okay? And so even if you're presented with an irreversible path, if you can devise a reversible path and do your calculations that way, delta E and delta H must be the same. Okay? Now you've devised your path. Now you need to calculate Q and W, okay? So you calculate Q and W using the reversible path that you came up with. This may be hard, this may be easy. You might have to think about things. You definitely have to think about things, but there might be some subtlety from time to time. You'll probably have to do some math, and you might have to calculate PV and T at intermediate points along your path. That's the great thing about using ideal gases. If I go from P1 and V1 using an isothermal path, then I can immediately calculate P2 and V2 as long as I know either P2 or V2. So if P1, V1 equals nRT, and I don't change T, I know the number of moles, the gas constant doesn't change, and then I go to the second pressure, I can already calculate what P2 is. So you can't forget your gen chem, sadly. And then step 3 would be, now that you've gone through your path might have several different legs where you're changing different parts at a different time, holding other things constant, and then you just sum up over all the individual paths. Okay, and so, if I go from, conceptually, if I start from here and I want to find out, here's point A, here's point B, if I can't calculate heat and work along this path, but I can calculate it from path 1, 2, and 3, then the change in delta E over paths 1, 2, and 3 has to be equal to the change in delta E from A to B. OK? Okay, so I would just add up the individual contributions. Okay, we'll actually get to this, but this is already the basis for something you guys have all done in Gen Chem. Anybody remember Hess's Law? Does Hess's Law ring a bell? So when you add up delta H's, and you're going from one set of products to a different set of reactants, and you want to use step by step and add your delta H's up along the way, this is why delta H is a state function. You can use any way to get there from point A to point B. Okay, so let's do one example. I'd say for now, let's go into your, for changes in a liquid, they have this in your book, so you can look up an example of how to calculate delta H and delta E for a change in a liquid, knowing the heat capacity and things like that. The main point of subtlety that you might have to remember is that in a liquid, unlike for a gas, if you change the temperature, the change in volume is probably going to be this very small, right? So if I take a glass of water and I heat it up from 25 degrees to 30 degrees, there's going to be a very negligible change in volume. And so you can use that because P delta V, which is our work equation for the expansion of the system, right? If delta V is very small, then you can say, well, there is no work done by the system as it heats up. So that's the subtlety for calculating delta E, delta H for a liquid. I'm trying to think if there's anything else we need to catch here. Yeah, the other subtlety is that if you're a liquid and you rapidly change the pressure on top of that liquid, there's no work done either, right? So when you're going up into a plane and you're sitting in the seat and all of a sudden the cabin pressurizes, you know, you're not sensing an increase in heat, are you? You know, and you're mostly just a bag of water. So you guys are all so much more than that, but chemically you're mostly a bag of water. And so intuitively, if you change the pressure above a liquid, you're not going to change the heat. There's not going to be a heat transfer. So, but take a look at that in your textbook. There is an example where it talks about how you might calculate delta H and delta E for a change in state of a liquid. But let's get on to an ideal gas, because I think this is a little more relevant, and I think we can ostensibly get through it before the end of class. Okay, so who remembers some assumptions about an ideal gas? What makes an ideal gas ideal? Anybody?
22.4.
Oh, that's way more complicated than what I'm looking at. So what properties of a real gas, or what, you know, thinking about real gas molecules, what properties does an ideal gas lack compared to real gases? Does an ideal gas take up any space? Like, do the molecules, I guess I should rephrase that, do the molecules in an ideal gas take up any space? No. So an ideal gas is infinitely compressible. So you can take an ideal gas and, like, you know, compress it down to the black hole singularity, and you'll never see any black hole because you can compress it even further still. Okay, so that's one. Do molecules in an ideal gas interact with one another? Nope. So they don't take up any space. So when they, you know, when it looks like, you know, if you imagine ideal gas molecule A and ideal gas molecule B and they're heading for a collision, and it looks like it's all suspensible and they just pass right through each other. So there's no interaction between ideal gas molecules. And that's where, you know, you can actually take those two very simple things and using thermodynamics, now you might not be able to derive PV equals NRT, but you can derive some things that you might have thought were just, you know, just crazy, that why did anybody ever think about that? Okay, so for our ideal gas, we want to heat 1 mole of ideal gas from one temperature at some initial pressure and volume to a second temperature in a different pressure and volume in a nuclear reactor. You could do whatever. Nuclear reactor looks cool. So how do we do our calculation of delta E and delta H? Well, remember, the first thing we have to do is come up with a path. And so the path that we're going to do here is isochoric, which means constant volume. So we're going to change pressure and temperature while keeping volume constant. And then our second path is going to be constant pressure, so isobaric. So we're going to change volume and temperature to get at constant pressure. Should underline the right thing. Okay, so how do we do this? Well, let's just imagine our piston system again. All right? We start out at P1, V1, T1, and we're going to do an isochoric or a volume constant change. So that means that delta V is equal to zero, right? So if I'm calculating the work at constant volume, now we have to go back to the equation that we derived on Tuesday. So work is equal to minus PEX times delta V, right? Or that integral there. Or we sum it up over lots of little tiny small changes in V. But we've already said that delta V is zero. So if there's no change in delta V, our work done by the gas is equal to zero. Okay? Simple. They're not all going to be this simple, I'm sorry. Now heat, we know we're at constant volume, and so maybe that reminds you, oh, I have a heat capacity at constant volume that I know for an ideal gas. I think it's 5/2 R, but you'll be given that number. You can also look it up. And so at constant volume, I know my temperature is changing. So if I go to P2, V2, T2, and my first step is constant volume, I know that my pressure goes one way, my temperature changes. And so I know that under constant volume conditions, I can use my MCP or N, I guess CV, delta T, as a way to calculate what the heat transferred or heat absorbed by the gas or emitted from the gas. Okay, and so we're using CV because we're at constant volume. And now, let's see, how would we do this? Well, we know those because those are given to us. I mean, we know it's going from T1 to T2. Yep?
How do you know that your heat capacity is
more? Well, we're given 1 mole of gas.
Okay,
so if I was giving you, like, I don't know how many grams of ideal gas in a mole, but if I gave you, like, a real gas where it was, like, water, and I said you had 18 grams of water, I mean, that's about 1 mole. But, and then I gave you the specific heat capacity, you could use that as well. So you just have, I mean, specific versus molar is just whatever is more convenient. And you'll have both in a table. But a lot of times it's easier just to remember what the specific is. Okay, so again, T2 and T1 are both given to you by the problem. So that's all you have to do. So now we've calculated work and heat for that first leg of the path. Now, the second leg of the path is isobaric. Okay, so if I'm given T2, but I don't necessarily know what P2 and V2 are, I can calculate those from the ideal gas, right? Yes? Yes, some people say yes, that's good. So P2 is equal to NRT2, which I'm given this number. I wish there was a way to mark that I'm given that. Maybe I'll underline it. I obviously know 1 mole of gas. That's not changing, so I don't know that. I know the gas constant. And V, I'm just using the original volume because that hasn't changed, right? So I've kept volume constant. So I know that. So I can calculate P2. Okay. Now I want to do my isobaric expansion where I'm keeping the pressure constant. Yeah?
I just want to be sure. So what you just wrote out using the P2 equals blah, 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 blah. You're using P2 because in the first leg, pressure didn't change. It was just constant volume. So technically, in leg one, you're already at a pressure two.
Right. Yeah, the point is of this, this kind of equation is that if I give you P and V, you can always calculate T. Or if I give you P and T, you can always calculate V. And so in here, I sort of give you all three. And I say that you know the beginning and know the final state. But on an exam, you might not be given all three. You might have to calculate, well, what's my final volume going to be if I start with P1, V1, T1, and I end up at you know, T2 and V2. You have to calculate P2. Okay? So now we're doing an isobaric expansion. And so we could do this where we're holding the pressure constant and we're allowing, we're allowing the gas to adjust temperature-wise. And so the way we would do that is if we're holding pressure constant, we're doing it slowly so that the pressure is, so that we're moving our piston out as the gas is expanding, and we're doing it reversibly, so we can assume that the pressure of the gas is equal to the external applied pressure, okay? And so when somebody says you're doing a reversible expansion, essentially you're basically moving the piston up, allowing the pressure inside the piston to equilibrate with the pressure that you're pushing down the piston, move it up a little bit again, and you allow that, and so you do it very slowly so that every point, the pressure that's being applied to the piston is essentially applied to the gas itself. And because the temperature and the volume are changing, that, you know, the pressure can remain constant as the piston goes up, right? So our work in this case, again, we go back to our equation, minus P dV. Normally this is the pressure of the system. But because we just said we're doing it reversibly, we can say that this is the external pressure that's being applied as well. And since this is constant, we're doing an isobaric expansion. You basically have P, dV. Yeah?
How do we know that it's reversible?
How do we know it's
reversible?
How do we know it's reversible? Mm-hmm. Because that's the only way we can calculate it. So again, that's something that you guys, remember we said we had to come up with a reversible path that we can do. The only way that we can calculate it is if we choose to do reversible. I mean, if it's not reversible, you can't.
We can just make that P.
Yeah, if you can calculate along a reversible path, you know it has to be true for an irreversible path, too.
That's supposed to be
Yes, it is, I think. Yeah. Okay, so we're going from V1 to V2. And so this integral is very simple, right? That's just V2 minus.
It doesn't matter though, right? Because the pressure is constant, right?
Well, yeah, well, the pressure is constant, that's why it comes out of the integral.
Yeah. But then if you multiply it, won't it still be zero?
Well, no, because remember, the pressure is staying the same. The piston is actually getting bigger, so the volume is changing at this step.
But that times zero is zero, right?
Well, this isn't delta P. This is actual P. Okay, so the P is not changing, but it's still a real value. There's still some real second volume that we're changing to.
Okay.
So we have negative P times V2 minus V1. Okay, and then Q is equal to, again, now we're holding pressure constant, so we use Cp, and Cp bar but, so here's where we have to use a little bit of our ideal gas. If we know T2 and T1, that's given to you in your problem, you can calculate T2 and T1, or you can use T2 and T1 here. Remember that you can also substitute in for the ideal gas equation. And so T2 is going to be equal to P2 V2. Over nR, and T1 is equal to P1 V1. So again, in this situation, we're given all P1 V1 T1, P2 V2 T2. So we don't have to do this. But if you're only given one or the other, you can always calculate T2 from the ideal gas law. So I'm drawing that in there just in case. And in that case, that would also equal P, which is constant, over nR. Okay, so now we've calculated work along an isobaric path and heat along an isobaric path. Yep,
Daniel. How did you get that last portion?
I took these two and substituted in here. So T2 is here, T1 is here. P is constant, so P1 equals P2, so that just becomes P. And then V2, V1 go here. So again, for an isobatic or an isobaric expansion, that's what you have for the heat.
Oh, you just substitute that into this. Okay.
Yep. So just so you have the both equivalent, because sometimes you might be given T, sometimes you might be given V. P is going to be constant, so you're always going to have to know something about P.
No, sorry.
Okay, just making sure. I know this is getting a little mathy. I apologize. And similarly, you could work it out for isothermal. Although I'm already 5 minutes over. So. Let's stop there. We'll pick it up on next Tuesday. Sort of spoiler is here on the next slide, so you can see where all the equations that we're deriving are coming from. And then I think next lecture we'll actually do some specific examples where I'm giving you, here's one pressure, here's one volume. So far we've been doing it generally, so just for a general P1, V1, and P2, V2, and so forth. Deriving for the different paths. Next Tuesday we'll do it for a specific path using the equations that we've derived here. And hopefully that'll make it more clear. So there'll be more time to see this. Again, the punchline is here on this slide. Similarly, the punchline for liquids and solids is on the previous slide. But remember to catch that in your book. Have a good weekend. We'll see you next week.
Right, like right.
Oh, well, okay, so it could have just been isobaric, there's a constant V, so V1 equals V2. So I could have easily just written standard.
I thought that pressure was constant.
This was, oh, let's see, what was I doing here?
You did it to find K2.
Yes, and so, okay, yeah, so isobaric, you're right, if pressure is constant, then you don't have to worry because P2 is equal to P1.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you'll still have to calculate it somehow.
Yeah, but you can find like V1 and V2 kind of like that same way.
No.
Yeah.
Okay. That's what you're doing. You're like just solving for each of them.
Yeah, so we could then, so then hopefully in the general situation, you can devise your own path and do the calculations as you see fit. Well, this doesn't apply to isobaric now because pressure changes. So there would be no, or pressure doesn't change in an isobaric situation. So this is just more of a general if you need to calculate P versus, you know.
Okay.
So.
Okay. Where are you from originally?
Pennsylvania.
Okay.
We need to test.